Hello, 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 and welcome to the local edition on a Thursday evening. I'm hosting tonight, Patricio Roballo. Jason has the night off. We have a packed show for you tonight, so let's get straight to it. In the second half of the show, we'll take a look at New York farms as they head into the busiest harvest season. It's not just about crops, it's about cultivating memories too. But first, it's Thursday on the local edition, and every Thursday, we are joined by the one and only Fita Pontuso, managing editor for the Hudson Valley Times Union. Philip keeps us up to speed on what's happening across the Hudson Valley. Philip, welcome to the program. One of the stories right now on the Times Union's website is Governor Kathy Hochul and the Democrats in the state legislature are being sued. This lawsuit centers around a law tucked into this year's New York State budget. It changes the required of non-public schools, including Shiva's, when it comes to meeting state education requirements. So, Philip, what can you tell us about this lawsuit?
So this is the latest in what has become really more than a decade-long tussle over how the state education department can regulate instruction and curricula in non-public schools, including yeshivas. And this lawsuit seeks to strike down a law that was quietly passed last year that that basically softened the standard that yeshivas have to meet. So a little bit of background here is probably necessary. The issue of alleged educational disparities in ultra-Orthodox communities is not new, but it's something that kind of got pulled into public view and quickly became a policy issue about a decade ago when this nonprofit advocacy group called Yafed filed a complaint with the state education department alleging that yeshivas were inadequately educating their students. That complaint was based on a state law that had been in place for more than a century but was rarely enforced. That law requires non-public schools to provide an education in basic subjects like reading, math, and social studies that's, quote, substantially equivalent to what students learn in public schools. This advocacy group alleged that in yeshivas, this wasn't happening. And they had a bunch of people kind of sign on to this effort who had graduated from yeshivas and were having trouble in life, basically, because they received a substandard education. There's been a lot of reporting, a lot of investigative reporting, most notably a big story that came out in the New York Times about a decade ago, looking at what kinds of stuff are taught and, more importantly, not being taught in some of these schools, and how oftentimes it doesn't really comport with the education department's standards that say all schools need to meet. So that complaint led to new regulations that were rolled out by the state education department, which basically mandated that non-public schools absolutely have to meet these requirements. Those were set to take effect this year, but Hochul and the state legislature agreed to essentially overrule those regulations in legislation that was ultimately included in the state budget back in May. So the mechanism for doing that was a new law that allowed these non-public schools to meet the state's, quote, substantially equivalent standard if enough of their students participate in exams that are either state approved or nationally recognized. So it was basically saying, like, hey, if like some percentage of your students participate in these exams, we're not going to look too hard at exactly what you're teaching. This was like pretty transparently an effort by state lawmakers and the governor to try to straddle both sides of a pretty contentious debate here. Like, I would say both sides on this are really dug in, and there's, you know, a lot of money that has been poured into lawsuits and advocacy over the years. You know, at the time, the Hasidic Orthodox leaders in Brooklyn who had been leading the charge to soften those regulations, they counted this as a win because even though it didn't reverse the state scrutiny entirely, they had opposed any kind of regulation or oversight under the argument of religious liberty. And, you know, they were basically operating in lockstep with ultra-Orthodox communities in Rockland County and Sullivan County, who tend to vote as a block on these kinds of things. And so there's a lot of political pressure on state lawmakers, particularly from those districts. So that kind of gets us up to what happened this week, which was a lawsuit that was filed in state Supreme Court on Wednesday in Brooklyn. This lawsuit is basically seeking to strike down that law that was tucked into the budget and require the state education department to go back to the level of regulation that it said it was going to do a few years ago and then like backpedaled earlier this year. And it's pretty interesting. The person who is leading this case is an attorney named Michael Rebel. He is the executive director of the Center for Educational Equity at the Teachers College of Columbia University. And he is uniquely situated to argue this case. He secured the decision from the state's highest court about three decades ago that established a state constitutional right to a sound basic education for children in New York. That ultimately changed how education funding is distributed in the state of New York, and it set the precedent that he's now alleging is not being met in these yeshivas, and that kind of underlies all the sort of policy wrangling and legal back and forth that has played out over the past decade or so.
Do you have any information on what the leaders in the Hasidic community are saying when they are confronted with these criticisms about the limited secular instruction that they have in their schools?
Yeah, I mean, basically what they've said, like I alluded to, or like I mentioned earlier, they say that this is an issue of religious liberty. And they say that the state really cannot mandate that.
What political implications can this have coming up, on election year to Governor Hochul, especially, the support that she does have from the Hasidic community?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely been in the back of her mind and in the minds of the representatives who got on board with softening the regulations in the first place. These ultra-Orthodox communities, be they in Rockland or Sullivan or in Brooklyn, they tend to vote in lockstep and they can make or break a politician's fate. Whether or not they'll have the weight to determine the outcome of the gubernatorial election, that's obviously a higher bar to clear. But people do expect it to be a pretty close election. Certainly, Hochul is going to be primaried by a Democrat, and she's going to need every vote she can get there. I can only imagine that's weighing heavily in their decision-making here. And I think it explains why they decided to roll back or at least soften the standard for these regulations in the first place as part of the budget negotiations, basically trying to get in front of any sort of political fallout for them.
While we're keeping on the thought of election and what's coming up, I want to talk about the next story you have here about U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services issues new guidance in barring non-governmental organizations like the League of Women Voters from registering voters at naturalization ceremonies. What can you tell us about this?
Yeah, so this is something that is one of those things that just quietly happens. I think most people don't really know about it and probably have no opinion about it. And yet now, as a result of either explicit policy from the Trump administration or just more implicit sort of resetting of values and norms, is now being changed. And so what I'm talking about here is that at naturalization ceremonies, which are the ceremonies where people become sworn citizens of the United States, it's not been uncommon to have non-governmental organizations like the League of Women Voters or other kind of get out the vote organizations tabling in order to register voters. Obviously, one of perhaps maybe the key privilege you get as a citizen of this country is the right to vote. And it would make sense that one of the first things you might want to do after becoming a citizen is registering to vote. And that's why the League of Women Voters and other groups show up at these ceremonies. Now, the League of Women Voters is not a governmental organization. Obviously, they describe themselves as nonpartisan, and nobody has really had any kind of issue with this until recently. So as you noted, last month on August 29th, the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services Agency, which is the federal agency that oversees naturalization and other immigration services, they issued new policy guidance that bars NGOs from registering voters. In a memo, they quote, clarified that only state and local election officials are permitted to do that. They wrote that ensuring that these voter registration groups are nonpartisan is a burden, quote unquote, on the agency. And that they said that they sought to minimize the effects of this change by claiming that voter registration information will, quote, continue to be provided by state and local election officials or USCIS staff at the end of naturalization ceremonies, although there's no funding mechanism or plan for that to actually happen. And so this is, again, an example of like what on the surface might seem like a common sense policy tweak, but what many advocates are saying is an effect to suppress the number of voters. There, you know, we talked to some election officials and other voter rights advocates who say that this is just the latest effort to restrict voting access and to undermine confidence in American elections by the federal government. And I'll just touch briefly on another effort there. The New York Times, I think it was last week, reported that the Trump administration was in the process of trying to put together a national voter roll to look for evidence of undocumented people voting in American elections, which is extremely rare and not an organized effort. And over the past couple of months, at least three election boards in the Hudson Valley have received subpoenas from the Department of Homeland Security asking them to turn over information about individual registered voters in those counties, which they may suspect be undocumented people who registered to vote illegally. We know in at least one case in Ulster County, the person they asked about has not actually voted in any elections. So that's the background of this story. This story also includes some reporting from a naturalization ceremony in Ulster County earlier this month, the first one in our region, I believe, since this new policy. And kind of contravening the new USCIS guidance, the League of Women Voters showed up anyway, and they ended up registering 14 people who of the 40 who became citizens that day. And, you know, the reason why this matters is that, you know, we talked to one of the elections commissioners in Ulster County who said that the League of Women Voters and these other nonpartisan groups who show up to help with voter registration, it really helps the election board with registering voters. Like these election boards, particularly in smaller rural counties, are understaffed. They don't have enough resources, and it's not like they're getting more money in order to do this in the absence of non-governmental groups. So that's why people feel like the effect is that ultimately, more often than not, without those groups present, there will be nobody on site to register voters.
Yeah. Do you get a sense that the local election officials felt pressured by the federal policy, or you think they're sort of confident in sort of pushing back?
I think it depends who you ask, like, or which of them you ask. Like, you know, we talked to four or five election commissioners in different counties in the Hudson Valley and in the Capital Region for the two recent stories we've done on this. And one of them in Ulster County, the one I was just mentioning, she outright called this, you know, an alarming attempt to undermine trust in the election system. She said that USCIS cannot regulate state and local elections and dictate who does and does not register voters. So she's pushing back pretty explicitly. She was happy to talk in detail about the specific subpoena request that they, or the specific subpoena that they got requesting that voter information. And so she's been pretty vocal. Many of the other election officials have not. Like, they've really just only answered direct questions, or they have referred us back to USCIS policy on this specific issue. So, you know, I think it kind of comes down to the personal appetite to court attention and trouble. And, you know, given the political environment right now, it's hard to blame people who feel perhaps a little uncertain or unsure about whether they should speak up.
Let's move on to a different story, that's something that we also have covered, and this is the exposure to an unknown substance that's making its way into the jails. And this is the recent story you have here, that 19 people were sickened by an exposure to this unknown substance, and this is happening at Fishkill Correctional Facility. What details can you tell us about this incident?
Yeah, so this began on Monday when five incarcerated people at Fishkill Correctional Facility, which is in Beacon, began showing signs of intoxication, which is what the State Department of Corrections and Community Supervision told us in a statement. Shortly thereafter, other corrections officers and other inmates who had interacted with those inmates began displaying symptoms of possible exposure, and it just kind of spread. All told, as of yesterday, six inmates and 13 staffers have required medical attention. A couple of them were taken to the hospital, and at least three have been administered doses of Narcan, which is the opioid reversal spray. The state nor the sheriff's office there has officially confirmed what this substance is, but there's been a lot of reporting and certainly a lot of discussion in the law enforcement community about fentanyl making its way as contraband into state prisons, and the fact that several people were administered Narcan suggests that's at least what they thought was happening, but that's not yet been confirmed.
Yeah, I mean, I can see that conclusion happening because they use Narcan, but I don't know much about Narcan other than what its initial use for, whether it could be used for other things. Do you know how this stuff is getting in? And the reason I ask is because I remember when we were covering the story when the strikes were happening, and this also was happening at the same time. I remember I was speaking to Assembly Member Paula Kay at the time at the Sullivan County Government Center, and she was putting a call in wanting the mail to be stopped. And her thought process was that it must be coming into the mail, and she wanted the mail to be stopped temporarily, at least, to sort of figure out how can they stop these substances from getting in. And I don't know if your reporting has revealed that how these substances are getting into the jails.
No, we don't know at this point what the source of this particular substance was or how it got in. There's been other reporting that has shown that it's getting in various ways. That I've read that mail is one of them. Sometimes people try to smuggle it in. But I don't know. I can't really speak to any larger, more coordinated efforts about how that's happening.
Yeah. What has been sort of the reaction from Department of Correctional Department of Correctional Services since your reporting? Have you reached out to them, and what has been their response?
All we've gotten from them is just the confirmation about what happened. Basically, all those details I shared were from DOCS, the Department of Corrections and Community Supervision. They also confirmed with us today that they're still investigating the source of the substance and what exactly it is, and that, you know, more information is going to be revealed about that.
And six inmates and 13 staffers. Do you know if any of these staffers were, because I'm hearing that the National Guard is still involved in some capacity at these correctional facilities. Do you know if these staff members were National Guard or anything like that?
I don't. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Do you have anything else to add to this story, or any of the stories that might be one, if you want to talk about, that are coming up for the Times Union?
That's all I've got for today. But, you know, as always, we've got a whole host of other reporting on TimesUnion.com. If you want to read our Hudson Valley and Catskill stuff, it's TimesUnion.com/Hudson Valley.
Okay. We're talking to the managing editor for Times Union. Thank you so much for talking to us. We'll talk to Philip Pontuso, and we'll check in with Philip again next week. Philip, I do appreciate it. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Learn how the farms this harvest season are not only harvesting their crops, but harvesting memories. Local Edition on a Thursday.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
I think what we're going to see is really the diminution of the influence of the CDC. The CDC has issued recommendations that have been followed by states, every state in the country. That is no longer the case.
I'm Rachel Abrams. That's Today on the Daily from the New York Times.
On the next Jazz Night in America, a handful of young all-stars assemble. The Monterey Jazz Festival on tour.
Oh, the tour has been excellent. You know, it's been a growing journey for everybody, I can say.
I feel like I've been having epiphanies every day.
We've gotten to know each other quite well, I'd say. I mean, it really has become a traveling circus family.
I'm Christian McBride, and that's on the next Jazz Night in America. Sunday at 8, here on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to The Local Edition. I'm your host, Patricio Roballo. As fall approaches, New York farms are entering their busy harvest season. But as WXXI's Veronica Volt reports, more and more family farms are in the business of cultivating memories.
On a 3,500-acre farm in Scottsville, New York, Julie Ionoswick is walking down a dinosaur discovery trail.
Every once in a while, the gravel pits around here will come across, like, mastodon bones or teeth or things like that. Not unheard of in this area.
To be clear, there are no real dinosaurs here now, just plastic replicas. Ionoswick is the staff and customer experience director for Stokey Farms. She oversees all kinds of attractions like this trail, but also hay rides, a corn maze, a zip line, bounce pillows, a ropes course, and on and on. But I'm not here for any of that.
Where would you like Suzanne?
Where are the kangaroos?
Oh, I'll meet her this way. Yeah, she's carrying around her baby wallaby right now.
She is Suzanne Stokey, a seventh-generation farmer and owner of the farm's Harvest Fest, Christmas Trees, and Rue Ranch. And she is indeed carrying around a baby wallaby.
So this is our newest addition to the Rue Ranch. This is little Arlo. He is a Bennett's wallaby.
Arlo is just one of a troop of wallabies and kangaroos on the farm. And the story of how he got here goes beyond the Stokey family. It's part of a growing trend that's changing how farms do business. More and more farms in New York are turning to agritourism, or agritainment, as a way to bring in more revenue.
So we try to just make something that's a little different than everything else. And then you throw in some kangaroos.
It started back in the 1980s, when Stokey's father pioneered some of the farm's agritourism by adding you-pick berries and cut-your-own Christmas trees. Stokey's own love of animals laid the foundation for their animal attractions, and she got their first wallaby in 2018. Now, the Rue Ranch is more than just marsupials. There's emus, armadillos, a porcupine.
Rabbits, guinea pigs, chinchillas, our three species of tortoise, our bearded dragon. I think that said bunnies, chickens, a Patagonian mara.
But behind the whimsy is a serious calculation. People are drawn in by the novelty. They'll pay the farm's admission, maybe schedule a special animal encounter, and hopefully leave with some of the farm's products.
We always like to use the example of if you go visit a museum, the last thing you walk through is the gift shop.
Lindsay Paschow works with farms as a business development marketing specialist.
The idea around agritourism is that you're bringing outside consumers to the farm to learn about agriculture, but also to sell product, the mums, the pumpkins, any other things that are that agricultural produced.
According to the USDA and the Office of the State Comptroller, agritourism revenue in New York has jumped nearly 80% over the last decade. Paschow is a statewide agritourism specialist. She also owns her own operation, a lavender farm in the Adirondacks.
And I definitely have made my fair share of mistakes over the years, as we all do in life. That's kind of how I've gone down the road.
Paschow says the main drivers of revenue for most farms in New York are still selling directly to customers or to retail. But she says this model has become a lifeline for those smaller farms, especially since the pandemic.
I think things are just so unpredictable in our lives. So finding different ways to diversify and just bring revenue into the farm is important.
For families like Laura Carger's, the appeal from a customer standpoint is obvious. Carger lives in Webster, near another agritourism operation, Wickham Farms. Her three kids climb the wooden obstacle course and dash between other attractions while she looks on.
Yeah, they love the corn pit. They keep getting more every year, actually. So there's some new stuff since the last time we came, but it's nice. It gets them out, gets them doing some physical stuff versus the same old stuff at home. But yeah, it's something new every fall.
For Dale Wickham, that's the point.
We will try and make our guest experience better every single year. We'll always be trying to improve it. But while we do that, we want to stay true to our agricultural roots.
Wickham is a co-owner of the farm. His parents, Bill and Debbie, started it as a roadside pumpkin stand in the 1980s. Now, Wickham says they get more than 100,000 visitors a year.
No, it's amazing, you know, to see people light up because these are experiences that, you know, not all of us get to have. Like, I grew up driving tractors and, you know, growing pumpkins and taking care of some of the animals and stuff like that. And not everyone gets that experience. And just to touch something with your hand, to pick an apple, it's like, it's a really cool thing. So we get to kind of help, you know, be everyone's farm, be the community's farm, and be a great place where people can connect to the agriculture and make memories while they're at it.
But this model isn't for everyone, according to Paschow.
I always feel like agritourism's not for the faint of heart because you're going to have customers come onto your property and they're going to be all different walks of life and had different experiences. So,
and agritourism doesn't shield farms from other threats like unpredictable weather and labor shortages. And the market has gotten more crowded. There are nearly 1,000 farms in New York with some kind of recreation built into their business model. And Stokey says they're not just in competition with each other.
You're competing with everything from the Fringe Festival to the Grape Festival to kids' soccer team, you know, all of that. You're competing for people's free time. And in Rochester, there's a lot to do.
Stokey Farms Harvest Fest runs for 6 weekends through the fall. After that, they'll pivot to Christmas trees with a live nativity and visits with Santa. The animals are part of that, too. Stokey tucks Arlo the wallaby back into the pouch she has slung over her shoulder. She says even with the challenges, she wouldn't change a thing.
I have a great life. Who else gets to look out your back door, see the Christmas trees, you see your farmland, you see your heritage? And it's a good life. It's hard sometimes, but it's always life.
Veronica Volk, WXXI News.
Thank you, WXXI, for that. And thank you to the New York Public News Network. That does it for the Local Edition on a Thursday evening. Everyone take care of yourself. Lucy, have a good night. Everyone else, see you soon.
Support comes from Country House Realty, a boutique brokerage specializing in the best of Sullivan County. Country House Realty, offering exceptional spaces in beautiful places. More at countryhouserealty.com. And from listeners like you.
I'm Jeff. Join me Saturday at midnight for Electric Mountain. 2 hours of house, techno, indie dance, and more, plus sets by top local, New York City, and global guest DJs. From the underground to the highest peak, it's Electric Mountain, Saturday at midnight on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville. This is Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR.